This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We've got a lot to cover in this half hour, including a look at the fight against light pollution, led in part by one JMU professor. Also, a look at what seems to be eating Pluto. What's a rare victory in court for guest workers in Virginia? A new Virginia Tech survey reporting what patients really value in their health care. And the prospects for a California-style minimum wage increase in Virginia. But first, we've got a deep look at Sweetbriar and the efficacy of an all-women's college education in a co-ed kind of world. WMRA's Emily Richardson-Lorente visited the Sweetbriar campus 1 year after it was nearly closed down for an update and a look at where things stand now.
A couple things that I do on campus. I work in admissions. Giving tours and walking backwards are my specialty.
This is the sound of an admissions tour at Sweetbriar College, 1 year after its students were told to start applying elsewhere. Tour leader Hannah Bell was a sophomore.
Just so sad. I couldn't imagine going anywhere else. I didn't want to write applications. I didn't know how to lie on applications. Like, why do you want to come to our school? I don't.
The news was equally upsetting for faculty, many of whom were losing not just their jobs, but their homes on campus as well. Professor Hank Yoakum says the whole experience was surreal.
Yeah, it was a mess. And it took, you know, psychologically, I still don't think I'm back to normal. I mean, I was in a fog for many months.
Facing so-called insurmountable financial challenges, Sweetbriar seemed doomed. Enrollment had been falling for years. The college had been drawing down its sizable endowment faster than was sustainable, and the administration decided it would be kinder to close the college quickly rather than draw the process out. Sweetbriar's former interim president, Jimmy Jones, said this in a CBS News interview.
There's nothing you could have done to save the day.
There's nothing anyone could have done.
But after the initial shock wore off, students, teachers, and alumni decided they weren't having it. They launched a Save Sweetbriar campaign, began raising money, and went to court to try to keep the college open. Against all odds, they won. It's a day Hannah Bell won't forget.
The most amount of joy I think I've ever felt in my entire life, knowing that I'd be able to come home.
But by the time the court ruled in the alumni's favor, 4 months had passed since the closing announcement, and the college was already a shell of its former self.
Everything had been done except turn out the lights.
That's Phil Stone, Sweetbriar's new president. He came out of retirement last year to help resurrect the college. But when he arrived on campus on July 2nd, he found 1,800 emails in his inbox, no students, and virtually no staff.
Pretty bleak there for a day or two, but within 6 weeks, the school was open. And it's been almost, I think I could say, almost a flawless academic year.
Flawless, perhaps. But the school is now running with 27% fewer teachers and 58% fewer students. But they're working on bringing those numbers back up.
Any questions at all?
Today, Hannah Bell is showing a family from Austin, Texas, around campus. Brianna Garcia wants to study pre-med, and Sweetbriar is at the top of her list.
Well, it's beautiful campus, and I really want to come here, so I love it.
Do you have any concerns about coming to a school that almost closed a year ago?
Yes, I do. But I've seen, you know, the Alumni Alliance fight to keep it open, so I feel like that's not going to happen.
And it may not happen. But Sweetbriar is going to need many more students like Brianna to enroll if the college is to become self-sustaining again. Total enrollment at Sweetbriar has never been very big. When the closing was announced, the entire student body on this 3,000-plus acre campus was only 560 women. Phil Stone has his sights set higher now.
We need to get to 800. It'll take us 4 or 5 years to do it. But having a record number of applications at this point certainly encourages us that we're on the right track to get the number of students we need.
It's ironic that after such a PR nightmare, the school now has the highest number of applicants in its history, at least as far back as the records go. But there's another irony, too, a crueler one. Although the closing wasn't completed, it cost Sweetbriar somewhere between $30 and $40 million to initiate.
Forfeited tuition, insurance, legal fees, severance payments. We're having to claw our way back just to get out of the hole of the closing.
That's why Phil Stone spends a lot of time traveling. In the weeks before our interview, he'd been in China recruiting new students, and in New York, Texas, and Florida meeting alumni.
We're not asking them to just send in money so we can pay bills. We're simply saying make us stable enough that we can get through these 3 or 4 years of low enrollment till we can get to where we need to be.
And it's working. The initial Save Sweetbriar campaign raised over $28 million, and earlier this month, a mini fundraising campaign on the anniversary of the closing announcement exceeded its goal.
We set a target for $500,000 to raise in one day. We went over, so we said, okay, we'll celebrate the founder's birthday a few days later, and let's do it again, and we then went over again.
Of course, that fundraising success begs a question. How long can the urgency be maintained, even after the crisis seems to have passed?
I think probably 115 years. That's how long we've been here, and that's how long we want to be here again. You know, in all fairness, I'm kidding, but the alumni are not quitting. They love their college. That's why they saved it.
Want you guys to join with your classmates, ask questions?
Back on tour, junior Hannah Bell says Sweetbriar's second chance has given her and her fellow students a new appreciation for their school.
Everyone's that much more fortunate to be here and filled with gratitude. We know what we have. We know what we almost lost. No way it's happening again.
If you think of Sweetbriar as a genteel Southern women's college, then you're probably not surprised to hear this story open with the sound of horses' hooves. Yes, horseback riding is a long tradition here on this 3,250-acre campus. And sure, there's lots of other traditions you might associate with an historic all-women's college. Take the Holla Holla chant. But here's another sound you'll hear at Sweetbriar today. That's the sound of a robotic car running in a mechatronics class. It's part of the engineering program here. Of 45 women's colleges in the U.S., Sweetbriar is one of only two that has the accreditation necessary to offer a four-year degree in engineering.
And they would both turn on at their max speed with this.
Programs like this that train students for high-demand, high-paying STEM jobs may be one key to keeping Sweetbriar in business.
Which gives it the full 5 volts.
This particular class is small, just 6 young women. But it means lots of individual attention for engineering majors like Maddie Lee.
So do I even need this digital right?
You do, actually.
I got into schools like Virginia Tech, UVA, UMD, and I was a little nervous at being all women. I went to a big co-ed high school, so this is about a fourth the size of that. But I came here, and I just absolutely loved it. So I'm really, really happy I came.
Like many of the young women here, Maddie doesn't quite fit the stereotype of a student at an all-women's college. Unless, of course, the stereotype you have in mind is a whip-smart engineer in training who's programming a robot.
I think it's MC1 and MC3 because those are...
Maddie is only a junior, but she already has a job lined up working for the U.S. Navy when she graduates. In fact, the Navy is helping to pay her tuition.
So I have that lined up.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then after that, you send it the PWM signal.
Engineering department chair Hank Yoakum is teaching this class. He says he loves the small size.
It's often very informal, lots of people working on projects, a lot of hands-on experience.
In fact, in last year's Technology in Society class, Hank's students worked with a Brazilian man who had lost both arms and legs in an electrical accident.
We've been working with him for a while. It's a really challenging problem.
So the students designed and delivered a prosthetic arm.
That allowed him to brush his teeth for the first time in 13 years since he had his accident. We actually thought we'd probably bring it back to tweak more, but he really wanted to keep that. So really powerful educational experience for our students, but also for us. So we have an event for high school students coming up, not this weekend, but the next. And they're making an optical bass guitar, and that's what you're hearing over there.
Strengthening the engineering program is a high priority for Sweetbriar President Phil Stone.
Engineering program is really important to us, not only to give another choice to young women who come here, but for those who retain any kind of caricature of a women's college as something that involves no more than white gloves and pearls, if that ever was the case, this trumps that just immediately because engineering is serious business. And our women here are serious, whatever they major in.
So would that be a way to, like, turn it right or left?
A half century ago, there were 230 women's colleges in the U.S. Now there are 45. Of course, back then, many universities didn't accept female students, so a woman who wanted a higher education needed to attend a women's college. Today, the situation is drastically different. Women outnumber men on co-ed campuses in the U.S. They earn more bachelor's degrees and generally higher grades. So are women-only colleges still relevant?
Well, I certainly believe women colleges are as relevant now as they ever have been in history.
That's Michelle Ozumba, president of the Women's College Coalition.
What they have in common is gender is not the leading definition of who you are in that environment. There's an expectation that you're there to succeed, and you have a voice, and you have an opportunity to discover your whole self.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so you might make it 100 or something like that.
Back in mechatronics class, Sweetbriar Jr. Maddie Lee agrees with that assessment.
Coming to a women's college makes a really bold stance that you are all for women in leadership positions. I think they're great, and I think they'll be around for a little longer.
In the end, of course, Sweetbriar's brush with closure may be all the proof you need that women's colleges are on their way out. But look at it this way. A year ago, Sweetbriar's leadership had given up on the school, and then students, both past and present, banded together, ignored the experts, and found a way to surmount insurmountable financial challenges. That took strength, generosity, and grit. If nothing else, that may speak to the continuing value of an all-women's college education. For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
Thousands of guest workers come to Virginia each year to work in landscaping and forestry, agriculture and hospitality. Amusement parks, hotels, restaurants, and orchards say they couldn't operate without help from abroad. Unfortunately, some employers take advantage of these temporary workers, but a Charlottesville judge has ruled in favor of 200 of them who took their complaints to court. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Houseman has that story.
The Legal Aid Justice Center has won a $782,000 settlement on behalf of 200 guest workers who came to Virginia from Guatemala to plant pine trees across the southeastern United States. Attorney Aaron Trodden says three companies recruited them.
And in order to get to the U.S., they have to pay visa fees, they have to pay plane tickets. So these workers arrive in the U.S. already $2,000 in debt, and their employers did not reimburse those fees to them. And then they didn't pay them overtime. In some circumstances, they didn't pay them minimum wage. And there were periods of time where they didn't get paid at all.
The defendants, Star Forestry Service, Independent Labor Service, and White Pine Reforestation and Landscaping, didn't respond to the complaint or even send a lawyer to court. Trodden says the challenge now is to collect from those companies, which are based in Minnesota and Arkansas, then send the money owed to the clients who have returned to Guatemala. I'm Sandy Houseman.
An award-winning study by a Virginia Tech professor has found that for patients, the most important thing in healthcare is the care doctors and nurses show toward them. The professor did in-depth surveys at doctors' offices and long-term care facilities and found that quality of the connection with their doctors is the most important factor in overall satisfaction. Virginia Public Radio's Robbie Harris reports.
Even as the rising costs of healthcare have been cutting down on the amount of time doctors spend with patients, this study found that if that was quality time, it made all the difference to patients. Robin Russell is professor of business information technology at the Pamplin College of Business.
How the patient feels about the interaction, if they're able to talk to their doctor or their nurse practitioner, if they feel that their questions have been answered, that means quality to them.
These surveys are part of the ascertainment for reimbursement by Medicare and Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Russell says that at first, some healthcare providers thought these surveys were something like a popularity contest or a measure of who had the nicest waiting rooms. But it turns out that patients' interactions with their care providers makes or breaks the experience, and therefore the prognosis.
It helps because the patient is then more confident in the care provider, and then they're more willing to follow the instructions. So the patient satisfaction does increase the technical outcomes.
You can see a list of the survey questions online, and there's a site where you can put in your zip code to compare the quality of medical clinics, hospitals, and long-term care facilities in your area. I'm Robbie Harris.
California made headlines last week as lawmakers there announced a deal to slowly raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour statewide. But here in Virginia, that number is still $7.25, tied to the federal level. As Virginia Public Radio's Mallory No Pain reports, that's not likely to change anytime soon.
This year, Virginia Democrats proposed a higher minimum wage, anywhere from $8 to $15 an hour. Another idea was more limited, a mandatory raise only for people over 25 who work at larger businesses. There was also a suggestion to simply study the effects of raising wages. But those ideas were all quickly tabled in favor of continuing to follow Congress's lead.
I think it is likely that Virginia will continue to be dependent on federal action for setting sort of our base labor standards.
Laura Gorin is with the Commonwealth Institute, a progressive think tank in Richmond. She says Virginia, where workers make an average of $25 an hour, can afford to have a higher minimum wage.
Virginia's a relatively well-off state. Typical wages are pretty high in Virginia compared to a lot of states, and yet we lag a lot of other states in terms of our minimum wage.
29 other states have higher minimum wages than Virginia, including West Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
Well, finally, we turn our attention to the skies. The John C. Wells Planetarium at JMU held a week-long series of events designed to raise awareness of light pollution and of the steps that we can take to end it. Those events wrapped up last night. WMRA's Dan Easley spoke with one of the event's founders, Dr. Paul Bogard, who has also written a book on the subject.
What's light pollution?
Light pollution is a term we use to describe the overuse and misuse of artificial light at night. The problem isn't artificial light. Everybody likes it. We're going to have it. We need it in some respects. The problem is that we use more of it than we need,
right,
and we use it in ways that aren't very beneficial to us.
So what are some examples of overuse?
Overuse would be just lighting buildings, streets, areas more brightly than they need to be. What happens is essentially that all that extra light goes up into the sky, it goes into our eyes, it goes into our bedrooms, it goes all these places that we really don't need to have any light, and we also waste energy, we waste money, and cause different kinds of problems. People think we need all this light for safety and security. No one is saying, let's not have any lights or let's turn off all the lights. What we're saying is, let's use artificial light at night responsibly, intelligently, and thoughtfully, even beautifully. And let's have the light we need for safety, but no more than that. We can have thoughtful, efficient, responsible lighting at night and not have light pollution, not use more light than we need, or use it in ways that actually make us less safe.
What are some of the most surprising repercussions of light pollution?
No, I think the biggest thing is the effect on our human physical health. More and more studies are showing that our light pollution, our overuse or misuse of light is affecting us physically. It's impacting our circadian rhythms, those 24-hour rhythms our bodies use to keep us healthy. It's contributing to sleep disorders, which are tied to every major disease in the country right now. And maybe most troubling, it impedes the production of the hormone melatonin at night. And this has been linked to an increased risk for breast and prostate cancer.
So you wrote a book and you started this event. It's the third year of it. What got you interested in this? Why are you passionate about this?
Well, I was lucky that I grew up in a place in the country, northern Minnesota, where we still had naturally dark nights. And so I got to see the Milky Way from one horizon to the other and experience, you know, darkness so dark that you couldn't see your hands in front of your face in the woods. And so I think that imprinted on me. And when I got older and I started to realize that I couldn't see the Milky Way and night didn't seem as dark, I began to learn about this thing called light pollution. And once you start to realize that you're losing the stars because of light pollution, then you start to realize all these other effects of using too much light at night.
It occurred to me that there's so many poems and songs that refer to the stars, something that will always be there. We'll profess our love for one another, saying that our love will last until the stars fall from the sky. It seems to me there's a very human aspect to this, where we expect the stars to always be there, but because of light pollution, they're fading away.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, what I like to say is that we've taken what was once one of the most common human experiences, which is walking out your door at night and coming face to face with the universe, and we've made it one of the most rare of human experiences. And I think that has implications for us spiritually, psychologically, mentally, as well as physically. You know, it matters to come face to face with the universe and to try to make sense of who we are, where we are, what's up there. Who created all this? And I think when we lose that, when we look up and we see a dozen stars rather than 400 or 500 or 2,000 stars, it really impacts our life, our quality of life in many ways. night is going to change. We're experiencing the coming of LEDs. Light-emitting diodes are just everywhere for light, and that has the potential for real good when it comes to light at night, but it also has the potential to make the problems we are experiencing now worse. And I think what we're trying to emphasize, let's plan ahead. Let's say this is the kind of night we want. This is the kind of lights that we want, and ensure that 2025, the campus, the city, the valley are even more beautiful at night than they are now.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Yeah.
Thank you, Dan.
Paul Bogart speaking with our own Dan Easley.
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. As the data from New Horizons' encounter with Pluto continue to arrive at Earth, the surprises about what we're learning also continues. What's going on now? Something seems to be eating away at Pluto's surface. A flat, geologically young area on Pluto's western hemisphere has jagged cliffs marking its edges that look like a giant bite mark on its surface. What's eating Pluto? Astronomers with NASA's New Horizons mission think they know what may be going on. Data from one of the instruments on board New Horizons show that the cliffs are rich with methane ice and that the plains have more water ice. If that methane ice is sublimating, turning into atmospheric methane, it may be revealing a lower layer of water ice. If so, this process may explain the bite mark. This theory would also explain why the plains appear to be geologically young, with very few impact craters. If this theory is correct, it also suggests that Pluto has a water ice bedrock beneath its surface. If so, where'd all that water come from? We have a hard enough time as it is explaining how all the water on our planet was produced. What we do know is that investments in the robotic exploration of our solar system over the last two decades is revolutionizing our view of home. I am Chanel Verani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, administered by Everence, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about our News and Information Fund, how we fund our news, and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at the website, too. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.